Welcome to Macro Memo, a board agenda podcast exploring the impact of macroeconomics and geopolitics on business, with Mark Kennedy, George Lagarias, and hosted by Gavin Hinks. To access thousands of articles, guides, reports, and our upcoming events, sign up or log in at boardagenda.com. That's boardagenda.com. This episode is brought to you by Forvis Mazars, the international audit, tax, and advisory firm helping businesses around the world operate and grow with confidence.
Hello and welcome to the Macro Memo. My name is Gavin Hinks, editor of Board Agenda, your essential source of corporate governance news and insight, and this is our regular briefing on the macro trends affecting business and trade. We're in a mega election year, and this show is all about elections and their impact on business and economics. With me to explore results and prospects are our resident macro maestros, George Lagarias, joining us from Athens. Hello, George.
Hello.
And joining us from Dublin, Mark Kennedy.
Hi, Gavin.
Now, gents, it's been a while since we last gathered together in a podcast, so it'll be interesting to hear where you've been, what have you been up to. Give us a postcard. George, I hear you've been to Berlin.
I have, albeit briefly, for the Final Four. I am a big basketball fan. My team happened to win it after 12 years or so. Panathinaikos is by far the most successful team in the last 30 years in European basketball. So it was a pleasure to see them back at the throne.
Well, congratulations on that. That's good news for you guys. And Mark, I hear you've been to Orlando.
That's right, not to go to Disneyland. We were there for Vision, which is the Forvis Mazars US annual conference. And some people may have noticed we launched a new accountancy network at the start of June. So it was the first time that I was attending that conference as part of the rest of the world or the group delegation. And I suppose two interesting things. One, there was, I think, over 2,000 people at it. And the feedback I was getting very much as I went around was American business people want to do business with the rest of the world. And there was a lot of queries about how to do business with Europe, how to do business with the UK, and other locations outside, but I suppose as we're in the UK, we'll focus there. But very interesting. Not at all the kind of political messaging you get sometimes. Globalization is not dead in their eyes. Second thing, both going and particularly coming home, I have never experienced turbulence in an aircraft like I did coming back. And I think it fits with a theme. And again, a lot of feedback in the few days I was there from the US residents, that the weather in Florida is way out of sync. They're experiencing a climate that they don't normally get to later in the year. And the message of climate change, I think, is hitting home. And turbulence is obviously a topic of the day, but it was really interesting. We were several hours into the journey before anybody was allowed to move around the cabin. So, interesting trip.
Well, a little unsettling there. Let's hope the politics for the rest of the year is not going to be quite so turbulent. And with that, let's turn to the meat of our discussion. We need to get through European elections, an election that's popped up for France, and of course, the UK election on July the 4th. Let's start with the European elections. We saw a swing to the right, to the right-wing parties, didn't we, George? Do the results change the economic risk factors for the Eurozone?
I think the results are more the consequence of heightened economic uncertainty more than they change the economic risk. Obviously, they exacerbate the risk. It's a vicious circle. But I wouldn't say far right or far left. I would say that the problem is with the far. The more we stray from the center, the more we stray from mainstream politics, the more the problems are getting out of hand. Having said that, mainstream politics does have a huge problem. To deliver anything, it needs fiscal space. And to have fiscal space, you need to be able to borrow. And countries are at their borrowing and spending limits. That is why the center does not hold, because it cannot deliver growth at a time when, you know, the demographics are not very good and productivity trends are stagnant, to say the least. So the only way to deliver growth is through borrowing. And now, you know, with all the debt and the high interest rates, that's not easily done. So the center cannot deliver.
Mark, that's a bleak thought. How does business feel in the wake of the European election results?
I think uncertain. And maybe if I pick up on George's bleak thought, I think in saying, yes, the center may not be able to deliver, but neither can the right wing, and probably neither can the left wing. The world doesn't change, and those circumstances don't change just because you switch your perspective in terms of ideology. And I think particularly with the right-wing swing that we've seen, a lot of them are coming on a view that, you know, less immigration is good and so on. And they're actually making it harder for us to deal with the conditions, because more immigration is probably good for Europe and good for the UK in terms of getting our demographic balance right and dealing with some of the issues that George mentioned. But look, I think business people are a little bit different. I think in that we're all business people, part of us thinks about what's going on in the world generally. But when we think about business, what we want more than anything is certainty, or at least a reasonable period of certainty for a defined period of time. And entrepreneurs are very, very good at managing strategic parameters. So what they're looking for is not so much whether it's right, left, mix. What they want is their politicians to bring a period where we can plan with a bit of certainty and we can act against maybe some difficult circumstances, but we can act against them and take our businesses forward. So I don't think businesses will be less confident or nervous, but they'll be looking for forming governments to say, here's what we're going to do, here's what we're going to structure things so that you can start to work against that. I think that's the most important thing.
George, how far can the European Union and the politicians in charge provide that kind of certainty that Mark mentions?
I would say that, again, the outlook is not very favorable, in the sense that the more we stray from the mainstream, the harder it is for political leaders to come to terms. Look, I think the theory is fairly old, at least the theory I read. It's from the 70s. At times of uncertainty, Benjamin Spock, the famous psychologist, said, people tend to hug the flag. Okay, and that is what a lot of aspiring political leaders are selling. They see the uncertainty and they sell a solution, right? And the more patriotic or the more ideological the solution, the harder it is to stray from what they promised and find common grounds with, you said Europe, so the Eurozone is 20-odd countries. So how do you find common ground if you have 20 nationalist agendas or 20 ideological agendas? Back to what I said, which was not an accident, I found myself in a panel with a former Greek finance minister. Of all people, he told me that debt doesn't matter. We can always print money if we want to. It's the modern monetary theory. Which is not true, by the way. But the more I stayed on that panel with a lot of Greek politicians, some of which were mainstream, I realized that a lot of them have trouble functioning if they don't have money to spend. And to find money to spend, you either need to run a primary surplus, which is difficult and onerous, or you need to run a deficit and somebody needs to finance that deficit.
Mark, George makes some interesting points, but the really interesting one there, reflecting back on your comment about entrepreneurs being able to adapt, is that with a multiplicity of right-wing parties in Europe with competing interests, it's difficult to create the kind of stability that we were talking about there.
Yeah, I think you've got to think about the different institutions we have. So I think it's highly likely, even with the switch to the right, when you look at the mix of people elected to the European Parliament, that you're going to get a centrist president. I don't know who that will be. I think it's highly likely that Ursula von der Leyen will be reappointed as president of the Commission. And I think you're going to find then not a doubling down in a hard way, but a reflection and a kind of a refocusing on some of the strategic priorities that have been there for the last number of years. Things like the Green Deal, things like a common defence position, things like focus again on European capital markets and making those stronger. And I don't think any side, right, left, or indifferent, will really object to most of that agenda. I do think George is right that there is a kind of nationalist point, and I think the interesting issue there is not so much will Europe fragment, and I be honest with you, I get very tired of particularly Europeans looking for signs that Europe is going to crack. I think they're at something else entirely and a bit of a waste of time, to be honest. I think what they need to focus on is the fact that the European institutions have for many years, and even in the last 4 years, which have been more uncertain, managed to make progress on a lot of agendas. Not as much as we wanted, but they have made a certain amount. And I think the issue is really about nationalist politicians or right-wing politicians using parliamentary processes to make their point and delaying things. And I think you can see in the mood of what's being discussed around Hungary at the moment that the next parliament will take steps to limit that so that the broad sweep of European legislation, which is generally a consensus position, will continue to move forward well. So I'm not as pessimistic about that. And I think if there's an interesting point coming in terms of difficult times ahead, it's not so much within the right wing, left wing debate within Parliament, because I think, that debate will be there and we'll move on. But I think it's in what the stance the next commission is going to take in terms of some very large business decisions. We saw evidence in the recent days about the position that the European Union is now taking as regards some of the big AI firms, some of the big firms like Apple and so on. And I can see some challenging business issues there going forward, which, again, the European Parliament has taken a position I think that most Europeans like, and in fact, a lot of Americans like. I had dinner last night with an American colleague of mine who said he loves being over here because he can opt out of cookies, which he cannot do at home, and it drives him mad. So there's a debate there. But as you can see, I think that there are challenges, but I think they're going to be more on the business front than actually moving a political agenda ahead. So for business people, I think there's a food for thought in that.
George, just to come back to you briefly on this, one interesting point to make about right-wing parties in Europe is they've seen what Brexit has done to the UK. It's created an economic struggle here, and I don't think there's a great appetite to repeat that anywhere.
I would argue that, first of all, I would, Gavin, I would argue that they haven't seen. What is happening with Brexit is more keenly felt in the UK economy, but what I can say as somebody who holds both a European and a British passport is that, and having lived in London very long, Brits are very good at not airing their dirty laundry. Okay, case in point, when George Papandreou took over as Prime Minister in Greece in 2009, the very first thing he did, he's pointed to the secret deficit and he said it's not 3%, it's 15%, and that led the country to the IMF, okay, and almost destroyed the euro. British politicians and British media actually have the opposite stance, which means that presenting a good front outside is a core strength. So I would argue that they haven't learned, they haven't seen, because Britain is not a broken country following Brexit. It is a country that struggles to get back to trend growth, to be sure. But it's not a broken country. Nothing dramatic has happened. So no one is saying, in the Eurozone, yeah, let's do it like British, because they have a common currency. It's a lot more complex. But I would argue that Britain is not standing out as a bad example. Now, and having said that, for Europeans, Immigration is a very big thing. I'm completely on Mark Kennedy's camp on this. I think if you have poor demographics, then you need to come up with solutions. Okay, and natural solutions is the import of workers. But Europeans, and you know, living in this continent, sometimes they are livid. And to be sure, Mark spoke about a centrist European Parliament. Having said that, in 2009, Ursula von der Leyen appointed the Greek commissioner as, and I'm quoting this, the European Commissioner for Promoting Our European Way of Life. Okay, so we actually have one of those, which means that the European Parliament is also very sensitive to maintaining a European way of life, whatever that means, because I'm pretty sure it's not the same for a Greek or a Dutch or a German or an Italian. So the point I'm making is that, no, they have not learned. And if anything, there is no shortage of European leaders pandering to those insecurities.
Mark, just to finish up that discussion there, George agreed with you there over the immigration point. Is that a message that business can send to their politicians?
Yeah, I'd hope so. Look, I mean, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, in a way, we have enough people commenting in various media. But, you know, business people and businesses don't generally lobby on particular topics. But I think you've seen it. I mean, I read a fantastic article in The Guardian last weekend. Agriculture business in the UK, I don't remember the name of the business, but about how difficult things had become post-Brexit and really the need to have a sensible immigration policy so that they could get people working back in the roles that they had previously. And I think in that kind of way, you know, this, those kind of stories bubble up. So yeah, hopefully businesses will make their voice heard, but I think whether they'll do it in a coordinated fashion, that's another question. Before we move on, I just wanted to take George up on his European way of life. There is a European way of life. Of course it is. I think what we need to recognize is that it's formed by the Irish, Greeks, Ottomans at one stage, whatever you want. It's the melting pot is the European way of life, and we need to cop on and remember that, I think.
Well, on that note, let's move on to another part of Europe. Emmanuel Macron called a snap election for France after the European elections. Coming to you first, Mark, that must have created its own uncertainty on top of the election results.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was a big shock. I have a lot of friends and partners in France. I would say the universal reaction was whatever the French equivalent of WTF is. Nobody was expecting it. They really were not happy about it. And I think there's a real state of nervousness now. Now, I think that said, you're seeing two interesting things. I think you're seeing the French right wing softening its position and becoming much more, at least in messaging, kind of business centric, which is interesting. And I think it will comfort people because, again, I suppose our history generally, I mean, we have to be careful with history, but in a lot of cases, it's parties that are to one extreme or the other. When they come in, they start to act very much like centrist parties. So they're starting to make those noises already. I think that is comforting people. I think, however, business would prefer to stick to a centrist road. They don't want to go too far left or right in French politics, would be my view. And so I think they'll be hoping that the election goes in the right direction in that regard in a few weeks' time.
George, has the French election unnerved economists? I mean, it's a powerhouse in the European economy, isn't it?
First of all, it has unnerved markets. The spreads between France's 10-year bonds, well, all bonds and German equivalent bonds, are the highest they have been in over 5 or 10 years, you know, depending how you look at it. So that's number one. The French stock market has tanked. Since the beginning of the year, global stocks are up 10%. European stocks are up 7%. And French stocks are up now merely 1.8%. You know, and we're talking about big companies there. We're talking about LVMH, for example, right? Louis Vuitton, Moët Hennessy, at some point, the biggest company in Europe. So the markets are definitely unnerved. The economies are not unnerved, but obviously some light now is being shown on the French economic issues. So we have seen, for example, slowing domestic demand, and we are seeing slower manufacturing production. If anything, PMI numbers coming out next week could establish a trend there. So to cut a long story short, the French economy wasn't doing great before that. So I'd say, yes, I'd say markets are fairly unnerved. And what they're trying to figure out, so there's only one question for them. Is Marine Le Pen a political opportunist who will use a right-wing narrative? Let us not forget that, you know, some of her previous positions were against NATO. So is she an opportunist that just uses a narrative to gain power, but has a much softer agenda? Or is she saying nice words so that it doesn't spook markets to get to power, and we see what happens from there? At any rate, we won't know soon, because even if she does win this election, she's going to share power with Macron. And the system is very much president-centric in France. Okay, they have, you know, the president is very, very powerful. Prime minister, not so much. So, you know, you might, I think the worst case scenario for markets right now is one where in US-like terms, there's a sharing of power, not much gets done in terms of internal agendas.
That's an interesting thought, Mark, not much getting done. Cohabitation does create quite a unique set of circumstances for the French economy. What does it do for French business, though? Are they affected by the uncertainty? Do they freeze their activity and wait, or do they just get on with things?
I think they just get on with things. I think, I mentioned turbulence at the start of our discussion. I think we're living through a period that, you know, you might call the great turbulence or the great unrest or something like that. Everything seems to be volatile these days. That said, I think businesses are still going ahead. So the French election, I think for French businesses, is yet another uncertainty. They're probably less worried about who's going to be in the various roles in government, and more about, well, A, does it block things that, as George has said, and B, does it create, if the people on the streets don't like policies, a level of unrest, strikes, issues like that? That's top of mind, I would say, more than anything else. So, look, I think they're looking beyond it and getting on with business. I'm not getting a sense from French businesses that they're going to change their plans significantly because of the election.
Just staying with you, Mark, briefly, does Giorgio Meloni's time in charge in Italy give us any indication of how right-wing parties manage? Because it's very clear that Meloni hasn't been as hard right in power as she may have spoken while she was out of power.
Yeah, I think she hasn't on certain topics. And it possibly does. The same thought was going through my head, actually, is what are we looking at, what we might look at in France, a kind of Meloni-type approach in Italy, the French version of that Italian model. And I think the issue is this. I think politics today, moving away from business, has become very much about two agendas, one of which is probably being fiscally and economically sensible. And, you know, that's why I think Truss was such a shock in the UK. To have a Conservative pulling the pin out of the grenade was not what anybody expected. In fact, what we're seeing is that left or right, other parties are probably trying to plough something that's a bit down the middle, but they're being socially quite divisive. So they're either being socially very progressive or socially not progressive, depending on your stance. And I think that's what you may see in France, is actually social changes. And Meloni has certainly done things which are socially not progressive, and they're quite regressive. And I think that's where we may be heading generally in a number of European countries.
Well, that's an interesting thought. Well, your mention of Liz Truss gives us a moment to change tack slightly and talk about the UK. July the 4th, is the UK general election. Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak running to lead the country. At the moment, Keir Starmer's way ahead in the polls. Most experts would expect a Labour government from the 5th of July. George, let me start with you. Does that give investors some confidence about the future of the UK?
I would argue, Gavin, that given the developments in the UK in the past few years, investors are going to remain, and I'm talking about those investors who are interested in investing in the UK, they're going to remain on the sideline to see what the new government brings, because not being Tory is probably not good enough to attract swathes of investors back in the UK. They're looking, foreign investors are looking primarily for one thing, some sort of constructive way to move things forward with Europe. Okay, I'm not talking about undoing Brexit or anything like that, but a way to reach a quick deal regarding services going forward, a way to resolve issues with cross-border trade. Mark is in Ireland. He knows that things have smoothed out definitely in the past couple of years, but they're still not perfect. So I would argue that they would need to see some signs of mainstream and normalization. Okay, and having said that, and that is something that, you know, when we're talking about British businesses, it should be on the back of mind. If you're an American investor, it's easier to go to countries like Greece, Bulgaria, Romania, because there you buy distressed assets. You buy assets at very low valuations. Okay, in Britain, assets are cheaper than what they were, but by no means are they distressed. So to take on the extra risk, which the extra risks come from, you know, relatively higher valuation to what you do find in distressed assets, they need some sort of clear path going forward. Okay, and that is the problem with the financial world today. It is a little bit divided in the sense you either buy dollar assets because dollar is still the king of the world, and also the central bank with the highest interest rates for the foreseeable future, or you go to distressed, where at least you know you can get a lot with not so much money. To go anywhere in between it, I'm not just saying UK. I'm talking basically about most European assets. Takes a longer and more constructive narrative, and that narrative needs to be airtight.
Mark, there's a lot of work for Britain to do to bring back investors at any scale. One interesting comment I heard about Labour's potential approach to Europe is a kind of aggregation of small changes over time to bring the country back so as not to spook the Brexit horses over here.
Yeah, I think that's possible. I mean, and I think it would probably be received well in Europe, to be honest. I think Europe has moved on from Brexit in many ways. And, you know, there's not much choice. So I think the narrative's changed. We're not talking about it as much outside of the UK anymore. And I think given the kind of European parliamentary backdrop and the issues that Germany, France, other countries have, I think the idea of a big, big change is not something that they're going to have the time, capacity, whatever, to actually deal with, you know. So I think I agree with George. I think the issue for the UK is, and for a new government in the UK, is going to be how do you restore a narrative of things are moving in the right direction. And, you know, small changes to Brexit, sorting the Northern Irish situation a little bit more, again, sorting some of the other issues that British businesses suffer from with flows of goods in and out, services issues that are there. That's sensible. Doesn't take major negotiation, I think will be well received in Brussels.
And to stay with you, Mark, briefly, do you think business is looking forward to, and put aside whatever party is involved, do you think business is looking forward to a change in approach, a fresh take on economic policy in the UK?
Yeah, I think so. And I'm particularly being an Irish person, I'm not party political in the UK in any way. So you take it, any party that's been in power for as long as this government has, that hasn't had, let's say, a good run of it for a number of years. I think the chances are the majority of the population, including business people, are saying a bit of a new broom, it's a good time, you know, a bit of change will be positive. And I think what businesses will be looking for, you know, I said earlier that you might call this the great unrest. That's certainly true in the UK. And I think what businesses want is a sensible approach to how do you move things on Brexit? How do you move things on maybe some of the societal issues that are there? How do you restore confidence of investors? We talked before about capital markets and things that can be done. Again, that's an agenda you can work away at slowly, managing interest rates appropriately. They're all things to be done. So I think what business is looking for from a new government is actually be boring and do the basics. That's the most important thing.
George, very briefly, to close our segment on Britain, markets are looking for the UK to be boring. That would be quite refreshing, wouldn't it, after the recent times over here?
I think Britain's biggest strength is boredom. No offense, because boring means predictable. Boring means a legal system that doesn't, where laws and regulations are not changed too often. That is much needed by businesses. Let me remind people, once again, I go back to the Greek debt default a few years ago, that when the Greek debt was renegotiated, it was negotiated under British common law. Okay, so if Greece was to, you know, default on its debt, it would be settled in the British court. This is how much trust and faith, and I think it goes back to the days of empire, the international community puts on British courts. And I would argue that they even have a better reputation for decision-making than even American courts. So this boredom is Britain's biggest strength. And yes, I would love it if it became a boring, predictable country again.
Well, I think we'd all welcome a little bit of ennui over here in the UK. Thanks for those comments, chaps. Now, let's turn briefly to interest rates, because there's some interesting things happening there. The ECB's cut rates, but the UK and US look to be holding off. George, there's a bit of a fear of an inflation bounce, presumably. That's why people are holding off. And some interesting news, I think, from Canada, that they cut rates and then saw an inflation bounce. So that bounce is not just a kind of monster under the bed that may not materialize.
So back early next year, what we predicted was macroeconomic volatility, i.e., that we wouldn't see a straight return back to 2% inflation, nor would we see ever a straight rebound of inflation. We are far more likely to see macroeconomic volatility, and that in and by itself means higher interest rates, because when things are uncertain, central banks traditionally err in the side of caution. So in terms of inflation, Gavin, and that's very important for your listeners to understand, we experienced a big bout of disinflation, mostly due to the disinflation of goods, because services remain inflated. And why are goods disinflating? Because China wants to grab a bigger market share. It wants to regain its position as the world's biggest manufacturer in quite an aggressive way, I might add. Think electric vehicles, for example. So the issue of China dumping goods in Europe and America has been in discussion. Mark was the first one who brought it to my attention for at least a year now. So the point is, however, that after 7 months, Chinese producer prices are actually bouncing up again. They have been positive for the first time in 7 months. The PMI reports suggest that we are seeing input inflation pressures going up. So there are definitely upward pressures to inflation. That is why European inflation is sort of leveling off now at 2.5%. American inflation is sort of leveling up a little bit north of 3%. And yes, UK inflation is coming down, but if you look at that has a lot to do with price caps, energy price caps. If you look at wage inflation, for example, it's near 6%, 5.7, I think. Especially in business services, it's around 7. So that's not a number that breeds comfort. We have a long way before inflation is beaten. And I would argue that maybe we're going to have to live in a world where inflation isn't beaten, at least not nearly as much as it was for 20 years, but it's bound to make some comebacks and, you know, there's bound to be more macroeconomic volatility than we got used to in the past 20 years.
Mark, some interesting observations there, especially around input inflation and wage inflation potentially affecting business decisions and the prospect of current inflation rates being locked in for a little while. How does business adapt to that? How do they plan around that?
Well, I think it's been very interesting. If you recall when we started talking about inflation and it peaking probably 18 months ago or whenever it was, George will remember better than I am. I will, you know, with very high rates. There was a massive conversation amongst businesses and business leaders about, oh, we don't know how to deal with this anymore. This is something, you know, that we did 20 years ago. And so, interestingly, a lot of businesses found they did have the muscle memory and they put in place good management systems in the short term to make sure they were managing the impact of inflation, protecting their margin and so on. I think that's going to continue. I think business leaders are very rational. They've done the analysis that George has done and said, right, this is going to be volatile for a while. So we're not going to let loose the reins and say, let's just let inflation have a go at our business. And I think you'll see that. I think it's going to cause some issues in some industries where, particularly around wage negotiations, I can see some issues arising. Again, probably less in the kind of pure private sector, more maybe in the public-private sector and so on. You're going to have some issues there. But overall, I'm sitting at and looking at businesses in the UK, but more widely, kind of slightly amazed and impressed that fewer have had serious difficulties, which tells you that business leaders have done a pretty good job and I think are going to continue to do a good job in managing a volatile position.
George, just to finish off this inflation segment, we've talked about potential for bounce back, but there's also a lot of speculation that we should expect at least small rate cuts at the US, in the US and the UK later on in the year. Is that really on for later in the year?
First of all, I'd say if it's happening, it is happening near the end of the year. You are right. Although I would argue that if central banks are looking for more certainty, maybe they're just going to have to get used to more uncertain times, to be honest. But look, where central banks aren't stupid, they are comprised of very high caliber economists and they see the same thing that we see. Goods deflation is not enough. You need to get the sticky inflation, which is the services inflation, definitely somewhere south of 5 and 4% before you have a rate cut cycle. So the going theory is that we're going to see possibly one more rate cut out of Europe because it's already done one. I'd be surprised right now if they do another. And possibly one rate cut out of the UK and one rate cut out of the US before the year is end. And that is mostly to make sure that markets begin to think about rate cuts rather than actually, you know, reducing the cost of money. They need to assuage market fears.
And what if you're running the central bank in Canada? You've cut the rates, inflation's jumped again. What are you going to do?
Well, that is called a policy error. Or at least in this particular case, a potential policy error. It's not the first. This has happened many times. And central bankers would central bankers would rather be caught naked in the streets rather than be accused of such an error. That's why when they err, they are more likely to err in the side of caution. Okay, they know that it's the potential end of their careers if they cut rates and inflation rises. Whereas if they don't cut rates, you know, and inflation falls, then people are just going to call them stingy. But they know that's part and parcel with the job. Doing the opposite can severely undermine A, your career, and B, the central bank's credibility as an inflation fighter, on which its independence stands. This is the cornerstone of central bank independence, the perceived ability to fight inflation. If you fail that, there's no point in being independent.
Mark, Canada's an example to other central bankers. They'll err on the side of caution after watching what happened there.
Well, I think they will, but yeah. I think the question is, well, what are they going to do in the short term? And you know, if you extrapolate from George's comments, maybe they'll do nothing. My favorite economist has always been Keynes, who said, when the facts change, I change my mind. You know, so maybe changing their mind might be a good idea.
Indeed. Well, look, we've had a fantastic conversation. We've talked about the importance of boredom for the UK, but we are living in actually very interesting times with elections all around us and geopolitical uncertainty and an interest rate and inflation landscape, which we're constantly speculating about. How do you guys feel about the future? Are you optimistic or not? Let me come to you, Mark. Looking at the economic environment as it is right now, how are you feeling about the future?
I'm by nature an optimist, so I'm optimistic. I think if I'm sitting in Europe, sitting in the UK and our Europe, I'm thinking about three things. First of all, you've got some great assets that a lot of countries would love to have. You know, great people, great entrepreneurs, great capital base. You know, and in the UK in particular, I mean, we talk about some of the challenges, but the city is different. The city is still something which will draw international business through good times or bad. I think you've got rule of law and institutions in both the EU and the UK, which are tried, tested, and really important for doing good business. And the last thing, and probably the best thing, is, you know, the young people that we come across, whether in our business or through, you know, our kids, friends, and so on, they're unbelievable. They're better educated than the last generation, more open, tech savvy. You know, they don't betray any of the kind of nationalistic tendencies that we started the conversation about. You know, they're real internationalists. I think you look at that grouping and say, I have to be hopeful for the world, you know.
George, you optimistic? Young people are the future.
Well, business leaders like Mark tend to be optimistic, and economists like myself tend to be more pessimistic, hence it's called the dismal science. Look, I'm optimistic about risk assets. To be sure, valuations are not that bad. Ex-NVIDIA, which is quite possibly the, you know, the investment story of our times, we will probably never see its like, you know, as long as we work. Either that, I don't see anything which says valuations in equities are extreme. I see bond yields are very high up, and despite the mass issuance of debt, markets are gobbling up bonds at the 4.5% in rates. So, you know, I'm positive about markets and risk assets, and I don't see, you know, despite all the political hubbub, really markets aren't that interested. So, you know, I don't see any pickup in volatility unless we see an actual financial accident, which I can't predict. In terms of economies, the problem is the same. We're accumulating more debt to pay off more debt. There is increasingly less fiscal space. Without fiscal space, the political center is in trouble. So at some point, we need to rethink our economic models, especially in Europe, because the US and China have their economic models. It is us that in Europe and the UK, I would argue, that need to think about all that. And just to add this as a final comment, Europe needs to think first about thinking itself. How does it respond in the era of AI? What is a strategic plan? How do we think about AI going forward? And that is also the advice I would give to businesses. Businesses should not think about AI as much as thinking and the world as it is in its state, but as much as they should think about thinking. They should have proper thought frameworks, because this is no longer a world which is straightforward. It's going to be a volatile world for a long time. So you need a thought framework before you have a decision framework.
George, thank you for that. I'm going to sum that up as very, very cautiously optimistic at the end of your commentary there. Mark Kennedy, George Ligarius, thanks for joining us on Macro Memo. Thanks to everyone out there for downloading and listening in. We'll be back again soon with another episode. Thank you and goodbye.
That was a podcast brought to you by Board Agenda. To get the best in boardroom thinking and access a hub of expert insight, intelligence, and resources for boards and directors, sign up or log in at boardagenda.com. That's boardagenda.com.